I'm Brett Johnson, former United States Most Wanted cyber criminal, now good guy, and host of The Brett Johnson Show. Today's episode, episode number 86, Jordan Woolham talks about my hometown, Hazard, Kentucky, when we come back. All right, so we're back to The Brett Johnson Show. Today we've got Jordan Woolham from Hazard, Kentucky. We're talking about Hazard, Kentucky. Hey, that being said, a lot of people that listen to me, you may not have a clue about the happenings of Hazard, Kentucky. So what I was going to do, I'm just going to talk about Hazard a little bit before the Jordan interview comes in, just to just kind of set the stage. So you guys know or have an idea of some of the stuff that we're talking about. Hazard, so here's the thing. A lot of people, they have an idea of Appalachia, the people there, of being these hard-born individuals that, by God, you may want to watch your ass if you're in Hazard, Kentucky, or Appalachia as a whole. Now, here's the thing. Like they kind of think it's kind of like Deliverance. And I'm going to tell you something. Sometimes it can be, okay? But most of the time, it's not. We, the people in Hazard, Kentucky, or in Appalachia, where I grew up, and here's the thing, I grew up there. That doesn't mean I've lived all my life there. My father was in the military. He was in the Army, a captain, a helicopter pilot. I spent my formative years traveling the planet. We lived all throughout the United States, lived in Germany for 3 years. At the age of 5 or 6, I actually camped with my parents across Europe, which is one of the reasons that I cannot stand. I do not camp anymore. It was a very traumatic experience. To me, camping today is a hotel room, air conditioner, toilet, and a running shower. I don't spend time in tents because of that horrible PTSD that I got camping across Europe at a very early age. We moved back to Kentucky. My dad was downsized out of the military, became a coal miner, and we moved back to Kentucky. And we spent a lot of time on food stamps and on my dad's unemployment, things like that, because it was feast and famine. When the mines were going, back then you were making a lot of money. When they were not going, which was often, meant that you were on food stamps and just trying to make ends meet. And we moved back to Hazard when I was probably 8 or 9 years old. I'm very thankful that my dad was in the military. It gave me a worldview and an understanding and a look at people that I would not have had I grown up in Eastern Kentucky. For example, when we moved back to Hazard, I was told, hey, all the black people live on Liberty Street. And they did. Now, when you're 8 or 9, you don't really think much about it. You know, your parents say, okay, all the black people live over on Liberty Street. And you're like, okay, that's where the black people live. You don't think shit about it. Now, looking back, that's like, okay, all the African-Americans are over on one street, and that street is called Liberty Street, and that's where they're supposed to be. Yeah, you know, looking back, it's like, holy hell. So I'm glad. To a large degree, I'm glad that I did not grow up my formative years in that environment. Now, that being said, being that Army brat, being the product of two very toxic parents, the closest I've ever had to feeling that I had a home was when I was in Charleston, South Carolina. I had a house there in my mid-30s. That's where I made, when I finally got arrested and things like that. And I was a true criminal. Absolutely. I was a horrible, despicable person. But that was the closest I've ever had to feeling that I had a home. Now, I grew up in Hazard, Kentucky. Okay. Most of my years were spent in Hazard, Kentucky from 9 forward. It's important. I think people get this idea that the Appalachians are a lot like the movie Deliverance. You know, you got a lot of backwood hillbillies, you cross them, they'll kill you. That's not really the case. Now, that being said, we are and I'm saying we because I embrace my Appalachian heritage. We are a people not to be trifled with a lot of the time. We don't suffer a lot of bullshit, okay? We are a very poor people. We don't have a lot of opportunities. We don't have a lot of educational opportunities a lot of the time. So, and you're surrounded by mountains. So you're kind of a closed-in society. And what you see is you see a people that, yeah, we may not have a lot of money. We may not have a lot of opportunity, but we tend to look after each other. And here's the other thing, and I've said this before in my presentations. Eastern Kentucky is an area that if you're not fortunate enough to have a job, you may be involved in some sort of scam, hustle, fraud, whatever you want to call it. My mom, as I've said before, my mom was kind of like the captain of the entire fraud industry. Now, that does not mean when I talk about that, that everyone without a job is a fraudster or a hustler. That's simply not true. But there is a population that does that. There's simply just not a lot of opportunity. Jordan, I bring Jordan in. Jordan is an outstanding young man. He truly is. I wish that when I was his age, that I would have had the fortitude that that young man does and the insight that he did, that he does right now, because it took me many years to get the insight that I've got today. So I really like talking to Jordan, and I really hope the best for Jordan. Now, what we talk about, I mentioned my uncle. My uncle's name, he was Roy Campbell. Roy Campbell was one of the main builders of Hazard, Kentucky. He was a contractor. He was a he owned his own mining operation, things like that. Now Roy, a few years ago, was assassinated. And when I say assassinated, that's exactly what I mean. Someone comes into his house, they put him and his wife, he was, you know, an elderly gentleman at that point in time. They put him and his wife on their knees in the middle of the living room floor, and they shoot them in the back of the head and kill them. Now, no one has ever been prosecuted for that, which is, again, not horribly rare in a lot of these occurrences in Eastern Kentucky. But no one's ever been prosecuted. No one's ever been fingered as the murderer. Rumors have swirled that the cartels were involved, that the quote-unquote cornbread mafia was involved, that, you know, drug trafficking was a lot of the reason behind that. That has never been proven at all, but rumors have, you know, circulated. Now, the reason I say that is you see a lot of violence in Eastern Kentucky. It is not everyone. It is not. But certainly I grew up in that type of environment. My grandfather, Paul Campbell, I still remember him telling the story at what had happened was one of the city cops, one of the Hazard city cops, decides he's going to flirt with my mother when she's at a very young age, you know, teenager. And I guess she was driving. He pulls her over and, you know, kind of propositions her at that point in time. My mom comes home, tells her dad, my grandfather, that's before she had me. My grandfather loads up in the car, drives down to the Hazard police station, walks in, lays a revolver on the counter and says, "Hey, what did you say to my daughter?" And at that point in time, the cop starts kind of stuttering. No, he was not arrested, because that's not the way shit typically works in Hazard, Kentucky. But my grandfather tells this cop, "Hey, if you ever talk to my daughter again, I will plant you where you stand. Do you understand me?" And that is not uncommon. When my mom marries my stepdad, my stepdad goes broke as a strip miner, coal miner. And we lived in a 40-foot office trailer. And when I say we, it was my stepdad, my mom, me, my sister, and a work hand. We lived in a 40-foot office trailer for about 18 months and lived off of deer meat and fried cornmeal for that 18 months. And my stepdad, he finally gets enough money up that he starts buying a couple of chainsaws, and he goes out making mining timbers and builds into a logging company from that point in time. But the reason I'm telling you the story is when my stepdad starts logging, we were in the woods, and he had this small case bulldozer, and he drives the bulldozer into a field, into a clearing. And we're like 20 feet into the clearing before we notice, oh shit, this is not a clearing. This is a pot field, a marijuana field. So he stops the bulldozer. We're looking around like, oh shit, we are not supposed to be here. About that time, this old man, He walks out of the woods, you know, long white hair, long white beard, walks out of the woods, walks up to my stepdad, Jimmy, and they just start talking. And and finally it gets to the point where the old man, he's like, so how you doing today? And my stepdad's like, oh, I'm doing all right. That's good. You see anything? And Jimmy's like, no, sir, I don't see a thing. And the old man's like, that's good. Why don't you come down and talk to me when you get through working today? And my stepdad, he's like, no, sir, I think I'll just go on home if that's all right with you. And the old man, his name was Dan White. The old man's like, nah, why don't you come down and talk to me today when you get through working? And Jimmy's like, we'll be there. Well, it turned out that Dan White was a convicted felon. He was a good man. Now, I say that, you got to understand that you can be a good man and still be a criminal. Okay, and I'm big about this stuff. I don't think that I think there are bad choices. I don't think anybody is inherently good or bad. I've met very few truly bad people. So Jimmy goes down, talks to Dan. Dan was a pot grower. Dan had served federal prison time because Dan at one point had murdered a judge and his wife, wrapped them in barbed wire, and thrown them in the river. And he had gotten a lot of prison time and somehow had gotten his ass out. Well, when he got his ass out, he goes into growing pot. Him and his sons do. Goes into growing pot. And what would happen was Dan would grow the marijuana. And then he was partnered with one of the counties, bordering counties, sheriff's departments. And this sheriff department would use their police vehicles to come and get the marijuana. They put it in the trunk of the cars and they would transport it like that. And later on, that sheriff was prosecuted for drug trafficking. But so Dan and Jimmy and my mom, they become very good friends. And Dan fronts them a lot of marijuana seeds so that they can go into the pot business themselves, which was a horrible nightmare. They had no idea how to grow pot. Hell, they couldn't even grow a tomato. But anyway, the reason I'm telling you the Dan story is this idea of the hardness of people in Eastern Kentucky. For example, Dan was on federal probation. So when we knew him, he was on probation. And one day, probation officer comes to visit Dan, and Dan's sitting out on the porch of his house. Probation officer pulls up, and he's just talking to Dan. You know, he's sitting there, he's got his foot on the step coming up to the porch, and he's just talking to Dan, how you doing today? And Dan's like, pretty good. And they sit there and they shoot the shit for 5 minutes. And finally, the probation officer says, well, Dan, I'm going to have to, you know, go in the house and look around. And Dan's like, you know, today's not a good day. And turns out Dan had pot in the house. He was drying it out and processing it and everything else. The probation officer's like, you know, I got to go in and have a look around. Dan's like, today's not a good day. Probation officer's like, well, Dan, I still got to go in and look around. And Dan looks at him and he's like, look, you go in the house, I'm going to have to kill you. Now, do you want to go in or not? And probation officer looks at him and says, you know, Dan, today is probably not a good day for me to look around. And Dan's like, probably not. Probation officer goes back, never reports it, anything else, and things continue as they're supposed to be. These types of stories are not outliers in Eastern Kentucky. These things happen. Okay, these things happen. That being said, while Eastern Kentuckians can be a very hard people, it's important that you understand that Eastern Kentucky, our Appalachian people, are very caring people. We truly are. Even though we don't have a lot of stuff, we don't have a lot of money, we don't have a lot of material goods, we don't have the nicest homes, we don't eat the best food, we don't have the best education. You know, even though we don't have that, we are a people that look out for each other. We are a people that care for each other. And I just wanted to preface this interview with Jordan so that you understand this. Yeah, sometimes it can be like the movie Deliverance. It's not very common. It happens. It's not so rare that it's an outlier, but it happens. But understand that the people of Eastern Kentucky are a very caring people. When I was, I moved back to Hazard when I was 8 or 9 years old. And I'm thankful that I did because it gave me that outside view. I'm also kind of sad that I did because it never gave me that feeling of Hazard and Eastern Kentucky being my home. But moved back there at 8 or 9, of course, the product of two very toxic parents that fed off of each other, my dad and my mom. But what's interesting, I don't even think it's interesting. I've talked about the abuse that my mom put me and my sister through, that the negligence, abandoning us at home until we, we had to shoplift food to feed ourselves. Then how my mom finds out that we're shoplifting and starts running us as little shoplifters, how my dad was in Florida at that point in time. My mom had left him. And, I mean, he knew the shit was going on. Make no mistake about it. He knew it was going on, but he never cowboyed up to get me and my sister out of that environment. And I understand the man didn't have a lot of money, but he was the adult. He was the father. And I've got to say, I've never had kids. I've got two stepsons. And I got to say, I've never had children. But if I did have children, like my stepsons right now, I would do anything in the world for them. If I was, if I had children of my own and they were at an early age like that, and I knew that, we were divorced, and I knew their mother was putting them through hell like that and abuse like that, I really don't give a shit what I would have to do, but I would make sure that my children were taken care of and out of that environment. My dad didn't do that. So, I've talked before about how the abuse led, my sister at one point, she tries to commit suicide. I'm the guy that, I become the carpet pisser. I start, my mom and dad, I catch them gone and I start urinating on the carpet. And I find out, it takes me 30 years to find out that, hey, that's not because you're a weirdo, Brett. It's because an abused child, sometimes that's the only control they have left. And then I've talked about how when I was 15 in Hazard, Kentucky, I beat up a woman on an elevator. My dad had announced that I thought my dad was going to save me, get me out of that environment. Find out that no, he tells me, no, I'm not. I've actually married this other woman. You're staying in Hazard. And I guess the culmination of the abuse of the of that conversation, of everything else, results in me assaulting a woman in an elevator. Spent 6 months, and I was a juvenile, I was 15. And spent 6 months in, they didn't have a juvenile detention center, so I spent 6 months in a solitary cell. The judge, I didn't plead guilty, but the judge, they put me on the stand and I said, yeah, I did it. Judge finds me guilty, of course. Sentences me to time served and then a psychological evaluation. They sent me to Louisville, Kentucky for that. And when they cut me loose from that, they wanted me to have therapy, continuing counseling. And of course, my mom, you don't need counseling. So that was the end of that. And the reason I mentioned that this idea of caring, I ended up, there were three high schools in Hazard, Kentucky. There was Napier High School, Hazard High School, and then finally Dills Combs. At Napier High School, which was the closest high school to where we were living, Napier High School, the kids actually formed a line and refused to let me in. And the staff and everyone else was fine with that. From there, we went to Hazard, and the principal told my mom, hey, Brett's sister is allowed here. Brett is not. So finally, and my mom was wanting to fight it. And finally, I told my mom, I was like, please just take me to this Dills Combs High School, because it was out in the country. And this idea of Eastern Kentucky people caring about each other. I had done a very bad thing. I had. No one really knew about the abuse and stuff like that and what caused it. I was just viewed as this son of a bitch who did this. And I still view myself as that son of a bitch who did that. But I know why I did it. I can rationally argue the abuse, the upheaval, the mental collapse, everything else that resulted in that. But at the end of the day, I'm the son of a bitch who did that. But I got to Dills Combs. And that caring attitude that I just mentioned of people in Appalachia pops in. They embraced me. They took me in and gave me that chance. And I excelled when I was there. I truly excelled as a human being, as in academics, everything else. I absolutely excelled in that environment. So I just wanted to mention that. You know, we talk about Hazard, Kentucky. Jordan and I do. I'm sorry if I went overboard and at length before the Jordan interview, but I wanted to talk about this kind of stuff. Jordan talks about, we touch upon the drug trade in Hazard, the drug usage, the addiction problems. As I was leaving Hazard, Kentucky, going off on my life of being a fraudster, OxyContin was in high use in Hazard, Kentucky. As a matter of fact, Hazard, Kentucky was the capital in the United States for the use of OxyContin. No one else was using it more than Hazard, Kentucky. And I had two friends that I grew up with, Fred and Brian. They both ended up overdosing on drugs. So Jordan touches upon the drug trafficking. He touches upon the lack of things to do in Hazard. We talk about a place called Fugits. When I was a child, this entertainment center opened in Hazard, Kentucky. It first opened with a skating rink, then they built a bowling alley. They had a movie theater, and then finally they had a water park. And it was outstanding. It was some place that the families could go to, that kids could go to. And the reason it came into being was because at that point in time, the coal industry was booming. Well, when the coal industry didn't boom anymore, people didn't have the money to send their kids to go skating or bowling or watch movies or hit the water park or anything else. So that establishment ended up closing down. All of it closed. And when you're in a county of people and you literally have nothing else to do, what do you do at that point in time? Well, you have a population that starts to use very cheap drugs, smoking pot, maybe fentanyl, maybe meth, any number of things like that. As I said, we don't have a lot of opportunity in Eastern Kentucky.
Oh, can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Okay. Good. Is it coming through this or that mic?
I think it's coming through your headset, man.
Oh, I guess it's my headset. He's got a microphone here too, right here. So I didn't know which one to use.
You're cool, man. How you doing?
Good. Making it.
Making it. I hear you.
You know how it is down here.
You know, it's been a while since I lived up that way, but yeah, I know how it is, man.
Yeah, I seen your podcast on Concrete and Lex's podcast. I watched it.
A lot of people watch that, man.
Yeah. It was good.
Well, look, I appreciate you coming on the show. I truly do.
No problem.
Well, look, why don't you tell everybody, you know, this is Brett Johnson's show. I'll record the intro after we get through speaking and everything, but why don't you just introduce yourself to everybody who you are, and we'll get started from there.
Okay. I'm Jordan Woolham, and I was born in Martin. Well, that's sort of Floyd County, but I was raised in Hazard, Kentucky, and really raised where the Fugit area is. If anybody's ever been to Eastern Kentucky, they know where the big water park, movie theater, bowling alley, skating rink was. It's close to the Breathitt County line.
Right.
And I live in downtown Hazard now, and I was raised in Vico a little bit through 10 and 15. I worked at Ride Center USA. I went to Perry County Central. Well, Hazard till I was a sophomore, then Perry County Central, graduated, then worked every summer Ride Center USA, which was Andy Cycle Sales since 2000. Okay. They changed their name to Ride Center USA.
All right.
And now I'm just, I had three heart surgeries, so I'm going through disability and trying to get that and just making it. All these doctor visits, I've got a bad back, four-wheeler wrecks, motorcycle wrecks, everything. And
well, dude, and how old are you, man?
30.
30 and three heart surgeries?
Yep. They started when I was 20. See, I used to play basketball, and I was a junior in high school, and I went up and dunked the basketball, and then I landed on my feet, and all of a sudden my heart went 200 miles per hour, like it was crazy, and I thought I was having a heart attack. I ran out of Perry Central's gym and called my mom. I said, I'm dying, and then she didn't answer, so I ran back in the gym, and then I just had a feeling to do something. So I stuck my head under the water fountain and it shocked my heart. And then after I learned that that's some ways to do it, if your heart goes into AFib or any SVT or anything, you can shock your body into. So after I went 7 years without going to the doctor or doing anything, I just thought it was me, you know. I hate doctors, so I just thought I was that was either panic attacks or whatever. And finally I went to the doctor and they tried to put a pacemaker in me at the ARH. I was like, I'm 20 years old. I really don't want a pacemaker. And the nurse was like, oh, children get them. You'll be all right. And I was like, still, I mean, I was still playing in men's league. They got a thing called the Dust Bowl they do every year downtown Hazard on the blue courts. And I said, I don't want to be hit around the chest and all that stuff. And so she was like, I ain't supposed to tell you this, but there's a doctor in Pikeville called Dr. A. And just Dr. A. And I called and he said, you don't need no pacemaker. And so I went through them surgeries, but come to find out, my uncles had pacemakers that I'm not going to mention the doctor's names, at ARH put pacemakers in them and they didn't even need them. When they went to my doctor, he was like, why do they have pacemakers in them? And I've come to theorize that it's a money thing for ARH putting pacemakers in people that don't need them. You know what I'm saying?
Let's be honest. I mean, we've got a lot of doctors down that area do a lot of shit. really need it.
The Cheneys, I don't know if you've heard of them, they got busted. FBI came in and wiped them out for writing a prescription pain medicine.
Well, it's funny you would mention the Cheneys, seeing how as they are my second cousins.
Are they? Well, listen, I'm not going to mention, but one of my family members was a dealer and one of the Cheney's husbands, I'm not going to mention names, but used to come to him and buy of him. She had a pharmacy and he got in trouble for robbing her pharmacy, his wife's pharmacy.
No kidding.
And he ended up being one of the ones that was on my cousin's discovery package for writing. So they caught him doing the pharmacy business. And he said, well, I'll give you one of the biggest names in Eastern Kentucky if you let me go. And and he was on the discovery package, sure enough.
Is that dude still in jail or not?
No, he served 7.5 years. They do it's conspiracy to sell. They try to get him for the RICO organized, but they couldn't because they couldn't get enough people. So it was just him. So they did conspiracy to sell. It's a 20-year charge. And where he had no priors or nothing, I was at the sentencing. So the judge said, it's a 20-year charge, but they in Fed, they go by like points, like how many points this serves this. And so my cousin's lawyer asked for lower, like 5 years. And the judge was like, no, you distributed too much into the community. I will do low. So they called it low and it was 7.5. Seven mids, like 14, and max is 20.
Okay.
So he had to do the 7.5. But the stipulations for him to get out, like I was listening to that. He was like, you got to go do a test every so much. You got to have a job. You got to have a bank account. Right. You've got to have. I was like, there's no way because he smoked pot all the time. I was like, there's no way he can make it. And then, well, he got out. I used to, my cousin go down there and send him money. He was in the London. They have a jail in London for Fed people. Right. And before they send him off, I used to go send him money, but he did it was not 7.5. It was about a 7.25. Fed time, they make you do most of it.
Yeah, it's 87.7% is what that is.
Yeah, and they let him out. And, you know, when he got out, he needed a job. And I actually went and moved in with him. And we worked. It was last year or the year before. Yeah, last year, I think. And we worked for Boyd Feltner Construction. I don't know if you've heard of him. He's done every concrete work around here. Right. And he retired, but when Brandon got out, he lives in the same holler in Fugits there. he needed a job. So Brandon asked me when he got out, he said, will you come live with me and work with me? And I said, I guess so. But I could tell a difference in him. Like, he was the same person. So one day I asked him, I said, are you institutionalized?
And the answer was yes.
Well, he said, I don't know. I talked to my mom because he's a mommy's boy. I talked to my mom about it. I don't know. Because I just see him looking at things, and the way he talked sometimes was a different than what he was. He was basically my role model when I was a kid. He raised me, bought my school clothes on and everything. Even though he was doing bad stuff, he still helped so many people.
Right.
I mean, he helped pay electric bills for everybody I know in the holler.
Right.
We kept the whole holler clean, even though at that time the skating rink burnt down. But we'd cut the grass all the way to the highway. But he was a good dude. But when he got out, we got into it for some things, and I ended up having to move back here to, I got an apartment underneath my mom's house. I'm upstairs now, okay. But on the computer, but yeah.
So, with Ace, is Ace still in prison or you get out too?
He's still in, but he's still in. His son.
Yeah.
I really don't know. Or his nephew. It's,
yeah, I've not talked to those guys. I forgot
his name, but, his son was in the mix with them, right. And he ended up. What's his son's name? Or the dude that sued CVS? Well, one of his family members sued CVS because in the mix of it, they thought CVS was writing some fraudulent prescriptions or something.
Right.
It came back that dude had nothing to do with it. Okay. And he was actually doing his job, even though he worked in Ace's office, he did his job right. Somehow he ended up suing CVS up here on the bypass.
Yes, sir.
I think for $14 million. They're closed down now. They moved.
They're closed down now.
Yeah, the CVS ain't there no more. They moved the whole hub. Do you know where Giovanni's is?
Yes, sir.
There used to be a liquor store there by Shell Mart.
Okay.
And, they made a CVS there now. The liquor store is not there, but it's a CVS now. Okay. So they just got one, and you should see the line there. So all the medicine that used to go to that CVS is down there, and it's packed all the time.
All right. Is it true that I was told that Ace, when he got arrested, that he bonded out and he bought a billboard that talked about the feds? Did he pull that bullshit too or not?
I've not heard that.
Okay.
I know that they went up there to his house on Hospital Hill and took everything. I think he had a Lamborghini. I mean, they stripped his whole house, even his office. His office had like fountains, statue fountains, everything. I mean, it was crazy. It was on, you know, where Hospital Hill is, where the fire department, it was across from that sort of. And, they took that building too, and they gave it ARH. So that Dr. Wicker,
mm-hmm.
He is a that's where he's at now instead of downtown. Dr. Wicker's office is in Ace's old building.
Well, let me ask you, Jordan, how bad is the drug problem in Eastern Kentucky right now?
Oh, it's horrible. See, when it first started, it was the OCs, you know, and people thought that was bad. But this meth that came down it's off the walls now. Like I wish I could go back to the days where people was just doing pain pills. Like, it's so bad. My granny lives down the street. You got people walking up there, knocking on the doors just to knock on the doors. I mean, people stealing boots off my front porch here. I mean, I've seen a dude that weighed 300 pounds last year, and now you see him walking, talking to himself, and he's 105 pounds probably. I mean, it's wicked.
Yeah. When did meth come in there, man?
I'd have to say about, it's 2023 now, about 2017, about 5 or 6 years ago. When it first came around, it was like a thing that people thought, I don't think it's real or not. I mean, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
You'd hear of the shake and bake people doing it in like Knott County or something, but then all of a sudden it hit, and then everybody was doing it. This dude I knew for 50 years lived up in Fugits, was a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
he ended up getting crazy on it, and the cops showed up to his house. He went outside firing bullets, and they shot and killed him. And he's the nicest man I ever met in my life. But he got on that, and it just, you know how it changes their brain chemistry? Yeah. And it was crazy. So
meth is the biggest drug in Eastern Kentucky
right now?
It's
the biggest, and heroin is the second after.
Heroin, too.
They use that after they want to come down from the meth.
Right.
And it's killing them. I mean, there's been so many deaths here that it's crazy. People that you wouldn't even think would be doing it and dying from it. But yeah, it's everywhere.
Just the combination of the meth and the heroin together is doing that?
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's what kills them. And the meth, the heroin usually has fentanyl in it. They don't want the regular heroin, because I know people that has done it. They don't want the regular heroin. They'll get sick just on it. They want it with fentanyl in it. So,
geez, man,
it's wicked.
Yeah, it sounds like I was in prison. This would have been probably 2008, I guess, somewhere through there. I grew up in Airport Gardens, bottom street down there on Gum Street, and set of us boys, me and my two first cousins, and out the end of the street there was Brian Russell and Fred Russell, and I got in word. I just got to Ashland Federal. And Brian had overdosed with a combination of Oxycontin and cocaine. And then it was the following, that was like Thanksgiving. And then the following Christmas, his brother Fred did the same thing. And that was the first time that the dying from overdoses really hit home for me there. But it sounds like it's a really bad problem right now.
Oh, it's really bad. I mean, I've had my best friend, before meth came around, he didn't pass away, but he was on cocaine really bad, and he was doing it real bad, and I'd have to take care of him. So I was the type that he'd run out, and I'd let him. He wanted to get clean. I'd let him come live with me for a while, and then he'd just disappear one day. You know how people like that are. They act fine, and then they disappear to go find their whatever they need to look for. But
buddy, how are they paying for all the drugs? Is it just stealing shit and reselling it, or what?
Yeah, that's it. They're stealing, trading mostly. A lot of people trade any collectibles. I'll give you this. My dad's done been charged. He's in federal time. I think he's got 16 years. They gave him 14 for the conspiracy, and he's a felon and got caught with a gun a few months before he went to jail. I bonded him out with whatever he had left of money, $10,000.
Right.
And he had, so they combined that. So he'll have to do the 14 years fed time and then 2 years state, because I think that's just a state time that gun charge was, maybe. I don't know what they did. Either way, I heard they combined it. I ain't talked to him much because me and him get into it.
Okay.
I was the only person to keep his underwear. Like, if I didn't get his stuff when he went to prison, he'd had nothing. His buddies, his so-called friends, would have stole and ripped everything they could out of his house. But I was able to go up there and get his clothes. He had some collectible coins.
Right.
This, his motorcycles and his vehicles, I took them. And he would anything. So he knows I like music. I play music. So people would come trade him, and I've hoarded up all kinds of stuff. I've got a couple guitars he's got. I've got Elvis. I've got records. I've got Post. I mean, just stuff like that. People would come and trade for, like, I don't know what's a cheap thing he'll give them or whatever. But he also paid people that to work for him, you know what I'm saying? That's just how people do around here. And but his downfall was the women that he wanted to spurge on. He's 56, I don't know how old he is, and he was acting like he was 20. I mean, he acted more childish than me when he got on that stuff and ran around poker machines. You know how they got these legal poker machines set up everywhere downtown here. And that's the hub. That's where a lot of them stay at. And the cops know that, and they bust them all the time, and they just relocate in another building, the poker machines do. But my dad would go spurge money down there. He'd go pick up these girls, and I got his discovery package. He mailed it to me, and he wanted me to blast it on Facebook to know who the rats was. And I said, I don't think I'll be the one to do that, even though I had his phone. I said, because there might be some legal reasons I shouldn't release a discovery package like that. But every one of them was dudes that I've told my dad that I wouldn't trust them with anything. But they ended up being his downfall. One of them was his girlfriend that he had for about a year or so. And I just about knew the way she was. And you should see what she was talking about in her package and her statement. She was in there like she was flirting with the police. I mean, it was ridiculous. And how he got arrested, it was weird. It's the first time I've ever seen it happen. They posted his picture and indictment in the newspaper before they arrest him. Usually they'll do it after.
Right.
So he had a week or so to know that they was going to come bust in the door. And so he was able to save up some money and put it away. And then they didn't come bust through the door. I was at his house. The shower was leaking underneath the trailer, and it was building up water. So I was there helping him dig a ditch and to run it over the hill. And he said, I want to go to the dollar store. Can I drive your car? Because I had a red nice. I mean, it looked brand new SS Monte Carlo. And he bought it off somebody, but it didn't even – it had barely any miles. Whoever had it kept it clean and sharp. It was red. The tires like extended out.
Right.
So it looked, you know, mean, nice, low man. And fat. And but he wanted to drive it. Next thing you know it, the girlfriend he left with, which is younger than me, by the way, you know what I'm saying? The girl he had is driving my car back from the dollar store hollering, Jeff's went to jail. He's went to jail. And I said, no way. And I said, well, I'm getting out of here because I figured they're going to come straight to the house and raid it.
Right.
So I left, and the girl was the only, I mean, she was there. And then like the next day after that, for 3 days in a row after they arrested him, they'd pull me over in front of Willie Miller's and Grapevine, everything. And I told there was a dude that always sit and lean back on his car like this, and let the other ones do the searching and everything. And I knew one of them, one of the state police, because I played ball with him. And he'd always be like, if there's anything you want to tell me, I'll help you out, anything. I said, I do not do that. That's his business. So I went back there and talked to the fake state police, because I said, because this is the second time I've seen the same group. I said, you have to be the DEA or something. And he said, well, I work with ATF, FBI, DEA, whatever. He said, you know, if my family asked me to do something, I'd do it for them. So I'd understand if you ended up getting what your dad had left over. And I said, listen, I said, my dad is good to my son, his grandson, and I let them spend time with each other. I said, if y'all really knew the relationship between me and my dad, then y'all wouldn't be pulling me over. His business is his business, and I don't fool with that side of the business. He's good to my grandson. I see him. He bought him a four-wheeler, this and that. But I said, that's it.
Right.
But, yeah, they hounded me like animals. I mean,
they leave you alone now or not?
No, I came home, stayed home for a few months, and they just let it be.
Okay.
So
I guess the girl, once your dad got locked up, her sugar daddy was gone, so she just talked to everybody in the world about anything and everything.
Right? Oh, they're still running around doing the same thing they was doing with my dad, which they carry backpacks, which they go around stealing people's stuff. They call it something. I can't remember. That girl told me something like it's called, I don't know what they call it. They got a nickname for going to other people's houses and stealing stuff and putting in their backpack for fun. Okay. And But they're doing the same thing. I see them all the time just walking around. I mean, it's 90 degrees outside. I feel sorry for these people out here, just no place to live, doing that meth and burning up. But they won't stop until they want help themselves. I mean, that's what I tell people.
Do you see a lot of them that want help, Jordan, or not?
What was it?
Do you see a lot of them that actually want help or not?
They do. Every one of them will say they do. Like, I've seen them say or go to jail and then be like, get out the next day. Because it's weird around here. Like, they'll get caught with meth downtown by the city police or something. They'll be out again the next day. It's like they spend something like, it'd be like going to jail for an AI and you spend overnight and get woke up. Because I think they use them to information. I believe that's the catch. Right. Just for downtown, I'm not talking about the state police. I'm just talking about the city police. I know how the state police work because they hounded my dad. But it's crazy because when I see them wanting help or they haven't done it for a while, they'll post the next day like on Facebook or something, oh, it's so good living in recovery. I feel so much better, and it's only been a day they ain't done it. You know what I'm saying? And then all of a sudden, they'll be living in recovery, and then 3 days later, they're back doing the same things again. So I don't know. That meth has to be a rough drug on them because mentally, it's hard for them to stop unless they get told to. There's a Casey law now in, I guess it's in Kentucky. I don't know if it's in other states where a family member can literally go to the judge or somebody and arrest them, arrest anybody, which I don't think that's a good thing because, I mean, I wouldn't want any of my family. I'd tell them mind their own business if it was me, but with that, I guess the family members think that'd be the best idea to help some of these people is to lock them up. And they do lock them up. It ain't like Casey Law gets sent to a rehab. It's Casey Law gets sent to a jail and then figure it out from there where you're going to rehab or whatever. So
what's going on?
But yeah.
So, dude, the drug problem is horrible. How's the economy up that way?
It's really bad. Minimum wage is probably like $7.25, I think, if you work at a McDonald's or anywhere, but there's not other jobs. There's no labor jobs. I was lucky to get on at that time with Boyd Feltner, but he still paid. It was after COVID and everything, just $10 an hour.
Okay.
And we was working 7 to 4 and, we was doing rough job, concrete work, you know, and in these times now, it should be like, what we was making should have been like $15, $16 an hour.
Yeah, at least.
The flood came and wiped everything out around here. This flood did wipe all of Lost Creek out, Rowdy, it wrecked everything.
Yeah.
Perry County, parts of. And we got bids to build bridges. We built one. I ended up in Knott County, built one bridge. I don't know if they ever continued once I left Boyd, but they said they had 9 builds. Perry County, they ordered companies out of state to come and rebuild their buildings, which I thought was a joke. I said, you've got construction workers right here in your own community.
Yeah, put your own people to work.
Well, I'll give you an example. It took Boyd usually has like a 7-8 man crew. He only had me and Brandon and his son, but his son is sort of a supervisor and boss. And we got that bridge built in 8 days. It took us 8 days to dig the footers, put the rebar in, build the walls, and then tie them down and then pour the concrete. I would see these crews with big cranes, equipment at one bridge for weeks at a time. And I was thinking, they're just getting money from the county. You know what I'm saying? I don't know why they dealt with it that way. They got plenty. It ain't just Boyd here, construction workers. I mean, there's a bunch of other companies here in our own community that could have built them bridges, bidded and built them bridges. But in this town, I don't know if you've lived here. You said you lived here and around Perry County.
Yeah.
It's like the people that's always been somebody is the people that's making money, like the officials and right. the officials' kids, and they always go off, they make money, or they end up being a magistrate or something.
Yeah, if you're not in the in crowd, you ain't doing shit.
Exactly. If you're not in it, you're not in it. And so everybody here just has to do something to survive, right. and it could be illegal activities, it could be hustling, it could be anything.
Well, I think that's one of the things that, you know, I think a lot of people don't understand that who listen to this show. I talk about I'm from Hazard, and, you know, if you're lucky enough to get a job, okay, but most people are not lucky enough to be in that in crowd or to get a job. So what do you do to make a living? Well, you do whatever you have to. You've got to put food on the table at the end of the day, you know. And now, one of the things that that's one of the sad things about Eastern Kentucky, but you know, you've alluded to that too, is one of the positive things is, by God, we stick together.
Yeah,
you know, we do believe in helping each other and trying to help each other. It's just a shame that you've got the drugs that are coming in there, where you've got people taking advantage of each other now.
Yeah, you know,
that's the shame of it all.
Yeah, it's wicked. And about that, like, still, I have moved to Cincinnati and worked at Amazon. I would always come back home. There's just something about here that I right. always would come back home. And the family thing, we, even if it's your neighbor, we always stick together down here. And you know, if people are doing things like that, they usually don't mind, as long as they're, you know, helping the community, helping other people, helping their kids. And my family situation, he had kids, so there was only a few things he could do. He worked at a bowling alley, that Fugus Bowling Alley, that he learned to work on the machines just by the owner, went to school for it. So right. He took my cousin under his wing and helped him build. Eventually, he ended up running the bowling alley. So we ran the bowling alley until, I don't know, it was after the coal mine shut down. So he was still managing it when the coal mine shut down. But when I was a kid, it was booming there. Right. Skate rink, movie theater, water park in the summer, bowling alley. And then all of a sudden the coal mine shut down, and it was just like night and day. People wasn't sending their kids out to do anything anymore because they didn't have $20 to give them right. no more. They didn't have nothing. So the skating rink was the first thing to go. Then the movie theater was the second thing to go. The movie theater still stands. The water park was like this, I think, the second thing to go, really, because okay. they couldn't pay the water bill. There's so much water pumping through there. And he had so much loans out on different properties. I think the movie theater, that owner did. And right. So the bowling alley was the last thing standing. And literally, on a Friday and Saturday night, you'd have the regulars, which would be about 10, 12 people. Yeah. And if any new faces come in, it'd be max 10. So some nights it'd just be 20, 25 people in a bowling alley that it was one of the biggest bowling alleys, and it's probably bigger than the one in Prestonsburg and Pikeville.
Right.
And so I know the electric bill costed $3,000 to $4,000 a month. And I don't know about the water bill, but I know because he'd always complain about electric bill, just keeping the lights on for them 20 people when it only cost $8 to get in.
Right.
You know. So finally, he was like, he was using his own money to keep it afloat. And finally, he was leasing it. He gave it back to the owner. The owner right. wanted to give it to him, but he said, I'll just lease it. But the owner ended up just letting it sit there until it burnt down somehow. Everybody has speculations.
Yeah,
and it burnt down. And she ended up selling the land, and now there's a church there. So the only thing in Fugits is there's we took the signs. They gave us the signs. Used to drive in, and there'd be a Fugits Entertainment sign there and American flag.
Right.
But the owners gave it to us to keep. We got them in a shack up in one of our buildings. But there's nothing there but a church now, and there's nothing for kids to do here. the city of Hazard is acting like they're on this renewable thing. They have a farmer's market now downtown. That's about it. They opened like two or three bars instead of the Broken Spoke's been there for probably 70 years now. Right. But they opened a couple new bars. Now they let people drink and walk on Main Street. Used to, if you got caught with a beer outside downtown Hazard, you was going to jail, or they was taking all your beer and taking you home.
Yeah, but, I remember, man. I remember when Fuquet's opened up, and you know, that's where all the kids went. You know, you went to the skating rink, or you went to see a movie, then bowling alley, and then when that water park opened up, I mean, that's where everybody went in the summer. I mean, that's where everybody lived at right there, and that was an amazing part of the area there to have your kids at.
Yeah, I was lucky because I don't know if you remember the white brick house on top of the bowling alley behind it, the hill.
I do.
That was my grandmother. So I stayed there. All that land behind there is my grandmother. And so my whole childhood, I was born in 92, so all that was built already. So my whole childhood was me, my granny giving money. I'd just walk off the hill and go do that all the time. All right. I started at the skating rink, and it's like you graduate up to the bowling alley, and then after the bowling alley, you go see a movie, and then in the summertime, you see the park. So, yeah, that was a lot of good memories.
Yeah, I mean, it was a good place. It was a good family place. What I understand the coal business put them out of business, but what the hell do kids do now in the area? Anything?
There's only the Perry County Park. They've got a pool there. There's a skate park there I'm pretty proud of. I was the one who got it built. When I was 14, I was skateboarding, but we'd skateboard in town here, and the cops were getting all over us by the courthouse, old courthouse, everywhere. And so I started a petition to get a skate park built because Knott County had built one.
Okay.
And that petition went to me making a video of all of us skateboarders, and then it went to there's a representative Brandon something, I forgot his last name, took it to him, and he was like, y'all gotta go in front of the Perry County judge executive, which was Denny Ray Noble maybe at the time.
Right.
So we had a hearing in front of him, but we had to estimate the money, this and that, the pictures of what it would look like, the diagrams. I had two buddies that was about 5 years older than me that skateboarded, that knew the business, knew how to build skate. But they was like, okay, we'll build it. And they had money set aside for it, which would have made it a really good skate park.
Right.
And then they said, well, we want a Perry County pool. So they lied to us and cut the money in half, built the pool, and the leftovers went to the skate park.
Okay.
And it's about to fall apart right now. Kids still go there. Like, I think, like, I had my son there. He rides bicycles, and I get worried. You look underneath, the metal holding it up is rusting apart, sometimes broken apart.
Right.
And I told some people, and they're trying to redo it. I seen one of the dudes that helped us get it built. He was up there redoing the concrete on some places, but it's just a bad location. I didn't want it there at the park because I wanted it downtown. We all did because we used to skate at the auditorium by City Hall where they have festivals and stuff.
Right.
And I thought the triangle, you know, the triangle where the old McDonald's used to be, the up and downstairs, would have been a perfect place. It's not a parking lot no more. They filled it with grass and.
Okay.
I said, well, that would have been the center of a good skate park where kids that live here could just roll off the hill and done it, but didn't happen that way. So that's the only thing to do here is the pavilion, all the ball courts around, and the Perry County pool and the park, and that's it. And the bars for adults.
That's about it. Man.
But every kid younger than me that I know, they just stay in front of a computer. So I don't.
Well, yeah.
When I was young, I was outside riding dirt bikes in the creek, doing whatever. So
yeah, that's not the way it is anymore, man.
Yeah, I don't really know if much any of them would want to do anything, because I always think, I'm thinking, wonder if these kids, like, I would have altercations that I'd have to solve my way out of when I was a kid.
Right.
Like, you know, if they ever got in a circumstance to where something happened or a fight broke out, like they'd be like, oh, what am I supposed to do? Like,
right.
Like when I was a kid, I'd maybe break a window. I'd have to have repercussions. I'd be grounded in a room with nothing.
Right.
No
right.
TV, nothing for weeks. And it's just, I don't know.
It's different now. I've got two stepsons, and one of them has no clue how to talk to a girl or anything else because he sits in front of that computer and that Xbox all the time, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's like that. So, hey, man, you said you had three surgeries. I'm going to let you go here in a minute, but how are you getting along now? You said your back was messed up too?
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you how the three heart surgeries went. Well, after I had that experience, they sent me to Dr. A, and they was like, well, you need an ablation. You got SVT. I was going up to 255 beats a minute, down to 40 at night.
Good Lord, man.
So they did the surgery. They went up my legs. It wasn't split open. They have these things now. They can go up your arteries and your legs into your heart, and they burn a piece of my heart because the electric rhythm or something was off. Well, after I healed from that, I was still having problems, and it got worse. I remember I was working at Sykes. That may be one of the steel only jobs that might be around here at Sykes. But, and I was depressed. I went through a bad depression during them times. Cause you got to also think I was also a big drinker. I was raised in the bowling alley. So, and my cousin ran it. So I was the only one allowed in there to drink. So, but I was depressed during that time, and my heart was doing different things. Instead of beating fast, it was also going off like AFib. So when I went back, they was like, oh, you've got AFib too. And I was just 20 then. I said, well, I've got AFib, SVT, supraventricular tachycardia or whatever. And they said, well, we got to get rid of this AFib because the first surgery ablation wouldn't work. So they have a harder surgery where they go up the same way, and it's a balloon. They blow up in my heart, and it stops it for a minute. I watched a video on it, and it, like, freezes a part of my vein. And they did that, and I hurt so bad after. I remember my chest felt like I was having a heart attack. But I healed up from that, and I was still going up to 255 beats. So imagine after that, I was thinking, I'm going to die. That's what I was thinking. Because before the second surgery, I was passing out in here in the kitchen, and I'd hit my head.
Yeah.
My heart would stop for 7 seconds, and I'd fall. And me, you know, I was playing ball and in these men's leagues. I was healthy. I've always been pretty healthy. And the third surgery they went in, they said, well, you ain't got AFib on it, because I had to wear a loop. It's a little chip they put in my chest. They said, you ain't had AFib no more. So I think we can do the first surgery all over again, and it'll do it. So I went in again for it, and they kept me in for 6 hours, from 12 noon to 6 at night. The doctor came the next morning. He said, I kept you in there so long because I shot you full of adrenaline just to make sure that your heart wouldn't go into an episode. And since then, I haven't had none of them episodes since that last surgery. But now I got blood pressure, so, and it stays high. So I have to take blood pressure medicine today, every day. And he also thinks I will need a pacemaker, because I went 6-7 years before I even went to the doctor for it, because I thought it was just panic attacks or my heart doing something.
Yeah.
So I'm just waiting on. I told him, I said, I don't want to wait till the symptoms start to know when I need a pacemaker. I want to know, like, when. And then now my legs just started trembling. Every muscle all the time just does this, bubbles up all the time. And I was just wondering why it did that 24/7. It don't stop. I went to a doctor. They said it was restless leg syndrome. And I was like, I don't think so. And I went to a neurologist, and he said, no, it's not restless leg syndrome, because people with restless leg syndrome, they get up and walk around and move, and it eases their legs.
Okay.
Mine never stop. It's all the time. So they did a nerve conduction study and found nerve damage, S1 radiculopathy or something they called it. And then I finally got approved my insurance, this Obamacare, It took a year for them to get me an MRI on my back, or I had to pay for it. But finally, they approved it. And they said that my things in between my spine are dissolving. I guess the cushioning. I don't know what she was saying. She was saying that. So she didn't think, she thought that was my back pain, but she didn't think that's what's causing my legs. So she wanted to do a brain scan. So I got a little worried about that because it looks for MS and Parkinson's, and they can look better by looking at the mind to see if you got any neurological disease.
Yes, sir.
And so I went and did it. But when I went to the doctor, they said, your insurance didn't approve it. I can't see it. And I said, I did it. How did they let me do it without, they should have known at the medical mall or the imaging center that my insurance wasn't going to pay it before they let me get in that machine and do it. And the doctor was like, I can't see it. So she said, I'm going to do a bunch of blood tests to see if you got fibromyalgia, arthritis, anything else, vitamins low. So this was just 2 weeks ago. They took, gosh, it was like 24 vials of blood. I remember telling that woman, I said, you think I'd live after taking this much blood? And so she's the neurologist said she's going to try to get that fixed. But I told them down at registration, I said, if that MRI comes back and it has some kind of tumor, EMS, or disease, and y'all have left me untreated for this long, that could be a settlement waiting to happen.
Yeah, I agree.
Because if that doctor gets the image 3 months from now and there's a tumor on my neck or my brain, they've left me 3 months untreated. They can't do that just because they also asked me, we can let the doctor see it if you can pay $50 a month. And I said, I can't pay $1,550 a month. Right. I said, I've got a child. My insurance is supposed to pay it. She's going to try to get it fixed, but hopefully.
Man, I hope so. Truly, I hope so. Yeah,
appreciate it.
Well, dude, I want to thank you for coming on the show. I can't tell you how much I appreciate it.
Oh, no problem. I'm a fan of yours. I watch all your stuff. I watch a few of your podcasts. So
yes, sir.
I'll keep watching.
Well, please do. And if you don't mind, I'll invite you back on sometime. We'll shoot the shit some more about Eastern Kentucky.
Oh, yeah, we will. I'll try to get some more points about it.
I got to tell you, Jordan, it's just good to talk to you, man. It's been so long since I've been able to just sit down and talk to somebody from that area.
My mom, she remembers you. We couldn't find the picture. I tried. We've got these big totes full of pictures and we tried, but she said it's in there somewhere. She couldn't find it, but she remembers you.
Well, you tell your mom I said hello, and I want you to know that talking to you, it feels like home, man.
Really I does. Appreciate it. You too.
All right, brother. You take. All right, so that was Jordan Woolham, a fine young man who has worked hard to make Eastern Kentucky a better place. He is an outstanding young gentleman, and again, I'm very thankful that he came on and agreed to talk to me about Hazard and, where I grew up. That being said, this is Brett Johnson's show. If you like the show, please subscribe. If you don't like the show, why don't you subscribe anyway? And leave me some feedback about what you like or don't like about the show. I read all the feedback. If it's good feedback, I will typically make sure that I adjust the show to accommodate that. People have talked about some of my earlier episodes, how I used to not stare at the camera. Well, you see, I talk to the camera now. People have talked about how, he gets loud on at times. I still get loud, but I've tried to calm things down. As I become more comfortable with doing this show, it becomes more conversational. So I'm really trying to make this show a better show overall. I continue to do the standalone episodes where it's just me talking about cybercrime, cybersecurity issues of the day, what have you. But I'm starting to bring people in too and interview them, a variety of people, so that we can get a better understanding of these things that are going on. My name is Brett Johnson. This is the Brett Johnson Show. Please subscribe. That being said, let's close things out. How do we close it out? Same way every single time. Stay safe out there. Stay secure. Stay vigilant. More importantly, this is the Brett Johnson Show. At the end of the day, just do the right damn thing. I'm Brett Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. Until next time.